Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Garrett Broad, Associate Professor of Communication Studies at Rowan University, and I'm delighted to be your host for this conversation with Andrea Wenzel, Associate Professor in the Klein College of Media and Communication at Temple University. Andrea is the author of Anti-Racist Journalism: The Challenge of Creating Equitable Local News. Of course, journalists have a long history of covering race and racism in the United States, telling stories that shed light on protest, activism, institutional turmoil, and policy change. Especially in recent years, though, the racial politics of journalism has very often become the story. Newsrooms across the country have had to grapple with big questions about diversity, inclusion, power, and professional standards in the media industry. What have these debates looked like up close? In what ways have newsrooms evolved? And what does this all mean for the stories we tell about our communities, our country, and the world at large? Years of fieldwork and engaged media scholarship featured in Anti-Racist Journalism offer some key insight to these questions. Andrea Wenzel, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
All right, wonderful. So to get us started, can you just give us a little bit of a background about yourself and your professional experience?
Sure. So I'm a recovering journalist myself. I started out in public radio in the late 90s and worked for about 15 years in public radio in Chicago and DC and various places. Along the way, became a little bit concerned about sort of the process of the work that I was doing and looking around newsrooms where they were majority white newsrooms, where we were often covering communities of color, but for majority white audiences. And that, I think, was one of the things that kind of led me into the space that I'll, you know, talk a little bit about today. I ended up going back and becoming a researcher by going back and getting my PhD after working for about 15 years. And through that and through all of this work, I have to be very mindful of my own positionality as someone who identifies as a white cisgender former journalist, that I've been part of some really problematic systems along the way. And there's limits to what I can know and see. And I cannot speak on behalf of journalists of color. I can just do the best I can to represent what people share with me. So,
Yeah. So, and we'll get into some of those problematic aspects and some of the things that you've seen that address them. So talk about, though, I want to hear a little bit about what work you actually did for this particular book. You focus on different media organizations in the Philadelphia area, telling some distinct but also intersecting stories. So how did you come to develop this project specifically in Philadelphia? What was the work that you did here?
Yeah. So I'd been having conversations with community members in Philadelphia and other parts of the U.S. for a while, talking with people about what they'd like a better relationship with local journalism to look like. And part of that was, you know, them creating their own media, doing kind of more community-centered work. But part of it was also their frustrations with sort of the harms they were experiencing that were coming from more mainstream news outlets. And so that made me want to think about, okay, so, you know, these harms are still going to be happening, even if people are doing their own work. How can that be improved? And I had the good fortune of living in Philadelphia, which is a city where there's been a lot of investment in local journalism. There's a lot of philanthropic work around local journalism here. And there are people who were interested in making their own newsrooms better. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, around the same time I came here and started out, I connected with Sandra Clark at the public radio station here, WHYY. And she was, you know, really invested in making her news organization more diverse, more culturally competent, better connected to the Black and Brown communities that are the majority of Philadelphia. And I connected with her and started collaborating with her. And so the book ended up accidentally coming to be out of a series of case studies of different examples from Philadelphia area news organizations, some two majority white news organizations, WHYY and the Philadelphia Inquirer, but also some startups that at the time their staffers were majority BIPOC, Black Indigenous people of color, including Kensington Voice and Resolve Philly. And then it's sort of looking at the larger context of how these all kind of gelled together and sort of what what it means to try to shift a local news system in the direction of greater equity. So that's sort of the big picture of what I was looking at.
Yeah. And in terms of your role, you already talked a little bit about your positionality, but in this book, you're not just analyzing this from outside. You're also at times participating and played a role in developing some of these initiatives. So how did you, at the outset of this project and throughout, how did you think about that relationship? Were there tensions there? Did you see that as a productive tension as the analyst and the participant?
Yeah. I mean, so I've ended up doing a lot of kind of these engaged research projects where it's tricky because I want to sort of use, you know, do what I can to help actually make projects work, but then, you know, also document them and look at them critically at the same time. And there's an inherent tension there. There's also a tricky dance of building trust with collaborators that I collaborate with on research, mm-hmm. but while also having to, you know, have enough trust where I can also share difficult home truths with them and be like, hey, you know, this project you're doing, you know, here's what's going okay, and then here's what's not working, or here's where people are sharing things that are difficult, that are you know, might be hard for you to hear. And so I have the good fortune with these cases of I was able to sort of be not being paid by these organizations. And so I wasn't working for them as a consultant. So I had some independence and didn't feel compelled to, you know, just share nice things about them. But I also wanted, I was rooting for them to do better. And so I wasn't like trying to play a gotcha role with them either. And so along the way, if I was learning things about, you know, here's, you know, you're doing this initiative, here's what's not working, I would try to share it with them as soon as I could so that they could hopefully, you know, do something. So it's not like I'm looking at it as an objective from a distance where I don't want to be involved. I was trying to help them whenever I could, but also like I wanted to critically document what was happening and try to learn from it.
Great. Yeah. And before we get to the case studies, I'd love to talk about some of the kind of broader conceptual and scholarly discussions that you're engaging with here. You just talked about, you know, not necessarily being totally an objective outsider here, which is an interesting keyword throughout this and discussions about journalism and race in general. So maybe we can start there. Like, what is the connection between journalistic norms and race and racism and this concept of objectivity in the history of how we think about journalism and the way it covers race and racism?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's unfortunately, you know, racism and white supremacy have been baked into U.S. journalism institutions, which were largely established by and for white people, you know, with many very notable exceptions. So, I mean, it's, you know, from the beginning has been a sort of a problem of news organizations, you know, being involved in actively harming communities of color oftentimes. And in the norms that people have adopted as journalistic norms, have been complicit in this. And so objectivity, this idea that journalists are meant to keep a distance from communities, are meant to keep a distance, you know, be sort of sharing both sides, quote, both sides, the way it's been interpreted has ended up reinforcing racism and white supremacy, because it ends up leading to sort of two sides, which are often two sides of people in positions of power, and it often ends up overrepresenting people who identify as white and male. Mm-hmm. And so objectivity just has, the way it's been implemented in U.S. journalism context has, you know, ended up reinforcing structural racism. And so, you know, alongside that, the idea of like colorblind norms, like the idea that it's been sort of intertwined with colorblind racism and led to a reluctance for people to talk about race in newsrooms where, you know, in the process of talking about a story, I can say this myself as a former journalist, like it's not like I didn't go to my editor and say, I want to talk to, you know, this many people who identify in this way, or you know, it was not something that was discussed amongst white reporters. It's, you know, I would say for many of us, it's been, you know, it's not been something that we were necessarily encouraged to talk about. And so With if you don't talk about it, the default ends up being whiteness and ends up being, you know, not thinking about like, okay, you know what, we need to maybe take a little longer on working on this story and go out and make sure we're talking to people who better reflect our community. And our community includes, you know, Black and brown people in this majority Black and brown city. And if we're not hearing from them, then we're just not accurately telling the story. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, it's ends up reinforcing white spatial imaginaries where we have this, you know, the stories are just not accurately reflecting reality. And so it's not about doing anything special, really. It's about just doing good journalism. But if you're not thinking critically about race and talking about it openly, then it ends up, you know, reinforcing whiteness.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the interesting things about the argument you make is that oftentimes when we think about structural racism and structural disadvantage and the role of the built environment, right, we think about, you know, access to schools or, you know, access to healthy food or the, you know, prison industrial complex. You also make an argument here that we should think about media as part of that built environment. And you draw from communication infrastructure theory. I should note that we actually went to graduate school together. We worked together on some projects that drew from this communication infrastructure theory with a group called the Metamorphosis Project. So could you just tell us, you know, you don't have to go super deep into the theory, but how does communication infrastructure theory help us think about these topics? In particular, you know, what is the relationship between media journalism and that built environment, that communication environment of local communities?
Sure. And I won't try to do justice to the theory, but I'll say that, you know, one of the cruxes of it is that every community has a sort of a storytelling network. So you have different actors within a community that are involved in sharing that community's story. And, you know, so you have local media, but you also have residents, you have community organizations, and researchers have found that in places where those are more connected, there tends to be, you know, more participation, more civic engagement, and it can just kind of lead to healthier communities as a whole. And so, you know, what I wanted to look at with this was partly looking at, you know, how does challenges with inequitable journalism end up, you know, affecting the communication infrastructure theory, affecting the storytelling network, and how does efforts to make journalism more equitable, how can those affect the storytelling network? And are there ways of better connecting local media with communities? Do these initiatives and interventions that are trying to make journalism more equitable, are they able to sort of strengthen the local storytelling network by strengthening the relationship between news organizations and the communities that they're intended to be serving?
Right. That's kind of what you talk about as accountability infrastructure. Is that right?
Yeah. So accountability infrastructure just basically means, you know, holding any sort of structure that can hold, you know, institutions or people with more power accountable to those with less. And so you can look at it within news organizations and trying to hold the news organization itself accountable to journalists of color, but also to communities of color. And so you can look at the relationship between news organizations and communities and community organizations and how to kind of create ways of holding journalism accountable to communities.
So let's look at some of these case studies. You mentioned already some of the names. I'm also from the Philadelphia area, so this was like kind of reading the paper about my local papers. But the first one was actually a radio station, WHYY, a public radio station. What should we know about that media outlet, but also about public radio in general when it comes to discussions of race and journalism? What is it with public radio and race historically?
Yeah. So, I mean, public radio has this word public as part of its name, right? And so you think, okay, so it should be reflecting and representing the whole community, the whole public. But unfortunately, historically, public media in the U.S. context has not really been that. It's been, you know, primarily, you know, it's disproportionately white and elite and, you know, well-educated, and it hasn't really reflected the whole community in a very robust way for the most part. And so WHYY was no exception. When I first started collaborating with them in, I think, 2017, you know, they were 80% of their newsroom identified as white. 80% of their audience was white. And then they went on to do a source diversity audit to look at who they were including in their coverage. And 80% of the people in their stories were white. And so
and that's in a city that's about 50% white or less than 50% white.
Yeah, like 40%. So there's like double of what the city was. And so that was, you know, a big problem. And, you know, or Sandra Clark, who is at the time, the vice president of News and Civic Dialogue, you know, said, this is a big problem and wanted to do something about it. And so I connected with her along this as part of this process. She wanted to do this source of diversity audit as part of a way of kind of showing to the newsroom that here's where we're at, you know, like this is where we are right now, because it can be hard to, you know, if you're doing your day-to-day work and you're trying, you know, you're not intentionally, you know, trying to overrepresent white people, you might not see it. And so she wanted to have sort of a baseline to show to her staff members. And so that's where I collaborated with her to kind of help them do this source diversity audit. And then she's like, okay, so this is our jumping off point. And what do we do with this information?
Right.
So she set up, you know, a bunch of different things. And, you know, she looked at how they did their hiring practices, how they, you know, looked at their workplace culture, looked at, you know, importantly looked at community engagement. And so they, and also just like, you know, the reporting process. So looking at, they did the source diversity audit where they looked at a moment in time, but then they required journalists to track who they're talking to in their stories over time. And so it became sort of part of their work for the reporters and for the editors to like, look at, okay, who's in our stories and who's not. And so that kind of changed a lot of the practices in their day-to-day operations.
Yeah. And so they had a bunch of these community engagement initiatives, as you noted, including some stories that were somewhat unconventional. It took us outside of the normal kind of NPR voice, as we often think of, hearing from community collaborators and community creators themselves. What did you learn from the WHYY case study? What worked? Were there challenges? Was there pushback? What did we learn from WHYY?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of things worked, but I mean, you know, they did, I think, make some improvements in terms of including more BIPOC sources in their stories. They did do some really interesting community engagement efforts where they had a project called, they still have it, called the NICE Project, News and Information Community Exchange, where they have like a network of kind of grassroots media folks who are doing different kinds of, you know, different kinds of media. And they would sometimes involve those folks on the airwaves. The challenge, though, one of the challenges that they faced was the community engagement work was not necessarily synced up with the day-to-day newsroom. And mm-hmm. so there were sort of silos, and the folks who were doing the day-to-day news didn't necessarily feel like they had the resources and the time to connect with the community engagement work, or they maybe just felt separated from them. And so that was one big barrier. The other was there wasn't a structure to, you know, hold the very top of the organization accountable to keeping this work going. And so, you know, Sandra Clark left her position, and, you know, then there became a question of, would this work continue? Would it be sustainable? Because there's all these projects that she instituted, which made, you know, good progress. But then when she left, there was no guarantee that these would continue. And, you know, I haven't, you know, continued on. I can't say firsthand, you know, conclusively anything about what's happened. I can say that there is a perception amongst people I talk to that a lot of things have not continued. And so it's a structural problem. If you can have these projects, but if there's not an infrastructure to make these, you know, an accountability infrastructure, then you can like only go so far.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. So on the other side of the page, I suppose, right, we have the big public radio station, but then we've got the big paper in Philly, which is the Philly Inquirer. And you take us inside the Inquirer at a particularly controversial point in time. There was a headline Buildings Matter Too. Can you tell us where that headline came from and what did that say about what the Enquirer's history and kind of present way of thinking about these issues was?
Yeah, so this was during the Black Lives Matter protests following the murder of George Floyd in 2020, where there was a number of, you know, they were doing coverage of the protests, but then there was this, you know, infamous headline, Buildings Matter Too, which was, you know, about an infrastructure. It was, I'm not going to try to go into the details of what the actual story was about. You know, it wasn't the reporter who wrote it, it was an editor, and it was racist. And they later acknowledged that this was a racist headline. And there was a pretty big pushback on once this headline was published, and it quickly became apparent that their problems went much deeper than this headline. This headline is just sort of one indicator of a you know, news organization where there weren't, you know, there was nothing to prevent this sort of thing happening, that where there was not the competency in the editorial staff to be like, you know what, this is really problematic to put out a headline like this at this moment or ever. And that they, the journalists of color within the news organization organized around this and you know, put forth their concerns and their demands for the organization to do better.
And so was that the Enquirer for All initiative?
Well, that was what became, so the journalists of color put forth their demands and the Enquirer responded with the Enquirer for All initiative.
And so what did that look like? And was that successful? What challenges did you see there? You talked a lot about kind of the work required, other issues with the business model itself. So tell us a little bit about the Enquirer for All initiative and strengths and limits there.
Yeah, so this was kind of a massive DEI response the Enquirer did. And I should say, so the way I came into this was I got pulled in as part of a group of Temple University folks who did an audit of the Enquirer, where we looked at everybody in their coverage and also just sort of the systems behind why the coverage was the way it was. Mm-hmm. It was no surprise that their coverage was disproportionately, including, you know, white people were overrepresented, blah, blah, blah. But the meaningful part was to look at sort of what was underlying those practices. And so the Enquirer for All response, where they said, okay, we're going to set up a bunch of committees and we're going to look at different elements of our news organization and our practices. It was huge. It had like 80 people involved at one point. And they were pretty deliberate about including not only journalists of color, but also including, you know, veteran, senior white editors and people in different levels of the organization. And so they had this pretty big response. They developed a number of different initiatives as part of it. They had like a Slack channel set up so that they could try to, you know, have a pre-publication space to talk about things and try to prevent things like the Buildings Matter Too headline. They had what they call an anti-racist workflow guide, which had some really interesting questions that journalists could ask of themselves at different points in the reporting process, thinking about who am I centering in my stories. They did a number of different initiatives, but there were some things that were called for in our audit recommendations and by the journalists of color that didn't happen or were, you know, the challenge, one of the biggest challenges with the Enquirer for All work was kind of a lack of transparency in sharing areas of progress and areas where there were challenges. And so one of the things that unfolded was some external folks who were watching all of this, you know, were getting frustrated. And, you know, they set up their own kind of accountability organization called Philly John, Philly Journalism Accountability Watchdog Network.
And for the non-Philadelphians, John is it's a term of art in the Philadelphia area that basically can mean any noun, and it gets used very widely. So the acronym would resonate locally for sure.
Yes, yes. And so they called out the Enquirer for a number of things, including the fact that at one point in time, there was, I think, one Black male journalist at the entire organization, reporter in the newsroom that was not covering sports. And so they called them out for things like that. They called them out for pay, like, you know, disputes over Black reporters being paid less than their white counterparts for doing the same job. There's a number of different things where incidents arose and they called them out. But they also made it, like they tried to have dialogue with the management at the Enquirer. Instead of dialogue, the Enquirer's leadership, sent out an internal memo where they were pretty disparaging about Philly John, and it was not, let's have a dialogue. And so things just broke down and got worse and worse. And at one point in time, Philly John gave, with the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists was part of Philly John. It was a coalition of different affinity groups and free press. But the PABJ gave the Enquirer a thumbs down award at a big gala where they had bought a table. So the PABJ gala, they walked over the thumbs down award to the editor of the Enquirer, and it was pretty crazy. And it was like, broadcast on Twitter. So things just went from bad to worse in terms of the relationship between, this accountability group and the Enquirer. And it was really kind of a missed opportunity, I think, for like constructive engagement. And, here's like this group of people who might be criticizing you, but they want you to do better and they care about local news. And at this moment in time, there's not that, that is a valuable thing to have people who are, external group of folks who really, want you to succeed and do better. And so, this is sort of an example of like, this could have gone differently.
One of the things I thought was really interesting about the comparison with WHYY and the Philly Inquirer is, WHYY, it was really proactive, as you know, right? They were thinking about these. They had a lead, folks in leadership that were pushing for some of these changes and developing these initiatives. At the Inquirer, it was much more reactive. It was after this backlash, it was demands being made by staffers. What did you think about whether it was more proactive versus more reactive? Did that change the way these things move forth? Was one more successful than the other? Did they both face the same challenges regardless of motivation?
It's really interesting because, I was assuming that the more proactive approach would yield better fruit and make a bigger impact. But in the end, in some ways it did, in some ways it didn't, because the challenge with WHYY, as I hinted at before, was there wasn't a structure to make their work sustainable. And so it was just so vulnerable for things falling apart. At the Enquirer, they set up a structure. It was very reactive, and it was a very, arguably the motivations, you could take a very critical look at their motivations and assume it's a very like brand centered, publicity kind of thing. But they did set up some infrastructure, and there were, some substantial changes, to a point. Right. The thing in the end, I think both of them had some big problems because there was just, for both cases, was really this lack of accountability infrastructure. There was, and in both cases, one of the things that I, came away with was there needs to be some way of having accountability at the tops of organizations. And the fact that you, in both of these instances, have boards that are not at all responsive to communities is one of the big weak links for this work, that, there's no accountability infrastructure. There's no, community centered boards. And so that's, a big challenge.
Well, with that in mind, though, your book then shifts to move away from these kind of big legacy journalistic organizations to more community-led initiatives with different visions of journalism, different ideas about what local storytelling, what local media institutions can and should do. So first, before we kind of get to some of the specifics, though, you really are committed to this idea of hyper-local neighborhood news. And this comes through in some of the case studies here. But wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about why, maybe going back to some of the discussions we had before about local storytelling networks, but why do we think in an age of, global social media, why does hyper-local neighborhood news still matter?
Because people still live in communities and they still need to understand their community and their place in the world, and, you know, have ways of connecting to each other. And when I talked to people about what they wanted and needed from journalism or media, or just in general about their information needs, they identified, you know, that, okay, we need to have better ways of connecting to each other. And so, you know, in some past work I did, after doing a research study in the neighborhood, in the Germantown neighborhood of Philadelphia, you know, people shared, you know, we have a lot of great things happening here, but we don't necessarily know about everything happening here because there's not like a place to find out about it. And we might, you know, might be connecting to each other. We're also, you know, continuing to be harmed by these big narratives, but we want to have some way of connecting to each other and, you know, having a way of sharing information and, you know, meeting in person sometimes, or, you know, whatever it might be. And so that led to this Germantown Info Hub project, that, you know, I think we first, it, you know, came out of this research study, started up in like 2018. And now it's continued on. It's become part of Resolve Philly, which is a nonprofit journalism organization in Philadelphia. But they do, you know, they have a website and they do some like solutions oriented, you know, solutions journalism stories and some community reporting. But their work is, you know, probably the more substantive part of their work is really just like sharing information and resources with each other, like, you know, sharing a newsletter, sharing, when we first started it, they would share like text messages and, but also just like convening people and having community meetings, having, bringing folks together to talk about community issues in person, you know, tabling and just like having an opportunity for people to come up and be like, hey, you know, we want to know more about this thing, this development project over here. Like, what's going on with that? Can you do some reporting on that?
So is that journalism, or is it some other kind of storytelling? And does it matter what we call it? I mean, I feel like a lot of journalists are deeply invested in that term and that it has particular connotations, but what's happening with Germantown Info Hub, what's happening with Resolve Philly and some of the other organizations you talk about, it seems like something a little bit different. So should we, could we, can we still call it journalism? What do you think on that?
Yeah, I am not someone who is highly invested in the idea of journalism with a capital J, some sort of like, you know, pure thing. I think a lot of people have, this is one of the reasons why I think there's been some popularity of the term civic media, and some conversations around like, should we just stop calling it journalism? I'm not really sure that that is the most important thing. I think that journalism, you know, I think that you can call it journalism and that journalism has a responsibility to inform people. There was a few years ago, a group of folks, including some of the City Bureau folks, came up with this like hierarchy of information needs argument where they sort of looked at the idea of Maslow's pyramid and thought about, what if we think about information in this way and what information do people actually need versus the what information is journalism investing in? And you have all these awards and prizes giving out, you know, prizes for things that maybe are at the top of the pyramid of sort of like this analysis that's, you know, very important and interesting and like great storytelling, but maybe not like people might need to know, you know, where to get free food or like where to get like, you know, like COVID information or, you know, like whatever, like there might be just information needs that are not, you know, beautiful pieces of storytelling, but that are still important parts of what journalism could be. And so I think that there's an argument to be made for just rethinking what good journalism can look like and that it should include sharing information with people and serving their information needs. That said, I'm not particularly like, you know, like if people want to like call it whatever, I don't care. I just want it to happen and be supported.
Yeah. And another organization you focus on that is kind of rethinking the ways to meet the information needs of the community is the Kensington Voice. They describe themselves as community-governed service journalism. And what was interesting about them is they're not just providing content or information, but other forms of community programming, community space. So how and why did that model emerge? And what did you find interesting about the Kensington Voice project?
Yeah. So the Kensington neighborhood of Philadelphia is another neighborhood that's been, you know, deeply stigmatized by negative media coverage, largely centered around there's a history of an open air drug market in Kensington and a lot of kind of, you know, really negative coverage of that. And so my colleague at Temple, actually, Professor Jillian Bauer-Reese, was, you know, very frustrated with this coverage and was working with students doing solutions journalism reporting in the neighborhood, and then decided, you know what, let me just ask community members what they would like. And so they did sort of a kind of informal like surveying and like engagement work, talking to community members about what they wanted from local journalism. And that led to the creation of Kensington Voice. And so then she worked very deliberately at thinking about how can this, whatever this thing is that we're going to do, reflect the community as fully as possible. And so she, you know, worked on having the staff members represent the majority demographic of the community. It's a majority Latinx community. She worked on they instituted a community-led board, where the board that has the governance and, you know, oversight of the organization is all community members. Hmm. And so it's a structure and set up differently, and they take their cues from what people say they want. And it's not, I mean, part of it is reporting and accountability reporting. Like they do a lot of, right, especially right now, and there's a lot of like political stuff going on in the neighborhood. They've ended up, you know, doing kind of some traditional investigative journalism, but they, a lot of what they do is also, you know, holding a youth workshop on whatever, or, you know, like doing different kinds of programming that most people would not assume is part of a traditional mandate of a newsroom.
You've mentioned the board a couple times in the kind of legacy media case, the board maybe being an obstacle to change, and then this more community-driven board for the Kensington Voice. Could you talk a little bit more about that? And in particular, you do talk about, you know, it wasn't all sunshine and rainbows with that board too. It bringing that kind of community voice at that level brings its own set of trade-offs and challenges. So what have we learned from the board at the Kensington Voice?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and this is sort of like, they're pretty young, so they're still learning about it, yeah. Right? But, you know, there's reasons why boards usually are the way they are. The people often get people on a board because they're going to maybe directly contribute money themselves, or they're very well connected to money. And so, like, that's a big function of a lot of nonprofit boards. They're also like, you know, let's get a lawyer, let's get a, you know, there's like this sort of traditional roles of who you need and want on your board. When you prioritize representation of the community, they're not all coming from those positions. And in fact, you know, they've kind of struggled a little bit, probably because they haven't necessarily had those connection points in their board. So there's trade-offs there, and being able to find ways, you know, people who they need to pay them, you know, because these are not people who maybe have the luxury, like their time is needs to be recognized and compensated in some ways. And so they just have there's a different dynamic when, you know, the roles are, you know, prioritizing different things. But the benefits, I think, are worth it.
Yeah. So after all these really interesting case studies, WHYY, Philly Inquirer, Germantown Info Hub and Resolve Philly, the Kensington Voice, you raised this really key question. I'm going to quote you at length here because I think it's really important. You ask, does it make more sense to strategically focus on shifting existing infrastructures and institutions or building new counter infrastructure? And if a both and answer is needed, given larger structural dynamics in the United States, what does that look like? So shift those existing infrastructures or build new counter infrastructure or both. What do you think? What does that look like? What do we do from here?
This is hard for me to answer my own question. I mean, I'll definitely say both. And, you know, what it looks like is really tricky. I think that we can't ignore harmful actors in the journalism space. Like, we can't just like say, okay, well, let's just give up on them because they're going to continue doing harm. And so like, we do have to, there is a place for continuing to try to repair news organizations that have historically been kind of harmful to BIPOC communities. That said, I don't think we have to keep sinking all of our money there. Yeah. And it's not working. And it's so much more transformational to take that amount of money and invest in organizations that can do things differently. And so you do see that happening to some extent. There's a number of different initiatives to try and support, particularly BIPOC-led and centered news organizations. Unfortunately, they're often not investing as much money, and they're not investing it in, operational transformational dollars, to quote Tracy Powell, who runs the Pivot Fund. When you look at philanthropic investment in Black and Brown organizations in particular, it's often has not been, giving those transformational dollars in the same way.
So philanthropy has a big role to play here. You think you talk about some of these external forces, philanthropy, you mentioned the Philly John external accountability group. You also talk about folks doing kind of repair work and DEI kind of work. What's the role of those external forces in this kind of rethinking of what community journalism might look like?
Yeah, there's a lot of different elements to it. And I'll say, on the philanthropy piece, I do think philanthropy has a possible role to incentivize good practice. I think if it's not done well, it can also sometimes go the wrong way. It can end up sort of not like channeling funds to people who are continuing to flush it down the toilet and not do good things. So it needs to be really thoughtful and mindful of power dynamics. I also think that philanthropy is not going to solve everything. And this, in terms of local journalism funding, which is another conversation that I can't do justice to, but I mean, certainly needs to be noted that I think public funding is necessary for this to really change things. And there's, you can talk to Victor Picard or others who can explain this better, but there are places that are already getting some elements of this right. If you look at New Jersey, where there's the Civic Information Consortium, mm-hmm. that passed the Civic Information Bill, and now they have a coalition of folks who decide how to spend that money, and are able to kind of do it in really interesting ways. So I think that there's a place for kind of rethinking the business model of this work and the funding of it. I think there's also a number of external actors and meta organizations that are sort of, kind of journalism support folks that have an important role. It's important that they don't just suck up all the money, but that they look at, there's a critique that some of these organizations end up sucking up all the money. I'll just say that, but there I think is value to those organizations being able to raise some challenging questions that are hard to do from within a news organization. You have people who have played roles as consultants or doing DEI training and who have done some important work. They can raise some difficult questions about how can you hold your CEO accountable? Or, I think they could do more than they have done in things like that. But, I think there's important things to be discussed about accountability infrastructure, about having community-led boards, about having, should there be term limits for CEOs? Should there be pay limits for CEOs? Yeah. Should there be, other ways of kind of creating accountability infrastructure that are hard to do when you're within a news organization where they are paying your salary.
This whole discussion of accountability infrastructure from the beginning of this conversation and throughout the book, you talk about it as really vital for building that trust with communities, and particularly, Black and Brown communities and low-income communities that have often been kind of marginalized in journalistic discourse. But there's also this counter critique, right, that says that actually all this work, all this DEI conversation is actually reducing trust. A lot has happened in the couple of years since the research was conducted for this book, even in just a couple of weeks and months since the book was published. There's been a lot of talk specifically at NPR. There's been a sort of big headlines. Trust in media is at an all-time low. And some people really make this argument that diversity and inclusion efforts are continually to reduce that trust, to actually make that trust worse. So I'm just curious, what do you think of that critique? Is there any merit to it? Is it reactionary? Or are there some things that we can learn about mistakes of DEI initiatives that we could improve upon?
I think both of, I think there's lots of things that we can learn about mistakes, but I definitely think it's reactionary. I think that, you know, there's many things that DEI work could do differently and improve upon. But I imagine my concerns are quite different than some of the concerns that have been raised by, you know, some of the critiques of NPR about DEI reducing trust. I think one of the biggest problems is that there should, I think there's an opportunity to reframe the conversation and shift away from, I mean, partly out of necessity, shift away from this DEI construct to just talking about what is good journalism? And shouldn't good journalism reflect our situation? And our situation is we live in a multiracial, theoretically a multiracial democracy, whether and that's quite questionable, but you know, in theory, we live in a very diverse society, and that if we don't have journalism that is telling the stories of that complete society, it is not reflecting accurately what our world is. And so if we don't have efforts to make that more accurate, then it's just not good journalism.
And I'd love to hammer home a couple more of these specific things, because you do have some real specific recommendations toward the end of the book. You talk about, you know, that the goal should not be a destination to be reached, but processes to be integrated into institutional frameworks and the day-to-day practice of journalism. So what are a couple of the big headlines? If you were, you know, made CEO or, you know, the national journalism czar or something like that, which we certainly don't have, although if you read enough right-wing blogs and things, you would think we do. But what are some of the big things? What are the most important processes we could integrate into journalism to tell those stories that you think we need to be telling?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it's hard to say like one or two, but I think like you can look at this from different, depending on your role, there's different entry points. So if you're a reporter and you don't have a lot of power within your newsrooms, there are things that you can do individually, even without a lot of power, to make things a little better. You know, you can look at your, you know, who are you deciding to include in your stories? How are you writing your stories? Who are you centering in your stories? Who are you assuming your audience is? Are you assuming that you have to explain a story about a community of color for white people? Because that's hopefully not the only people in your audience. So there's like questions you can ask about your own reporting. Likewise for editors, there's questions you can ask about your reporting. If, however, you happen to have a position where you can change the structure of your organization, then, you know, you could think about maybe there is a way to set up a community-led board. Maybe we can have a system allowing non-management staffers to vote on a new board member, or having community members having input on a new board member. Maybe if you're in a foundation, you can work on things like having community participatory funding. Here in Philly, we have IPMF, Independence Public Media Foundation, that's been doing some innovative work around participatory funding, where community members have input on how to spend money on media. So there's a lot of different entry points. I think of it as part of a community-centered journalism process. At different points in the, you know, reporting, editing, and distribution process, there's different ways to try to make the work more equitable. But really, you know, at the same time, there needs to be larger conversations outside of these news organizations about accountability infrastructure too.
Great. Wonderful. So we'll finish up here with what is the traditional New Books Network final question. You've put so much work into this book, and this came on the heels of another book that came out not too long before, right, on community-centered journalism. So I know that you're working on something. What are you working on? What are you thinking about these days, Andrea?
A few different directions. But, I mean, one of the things is sort of building on this is thinking about what function can journalism, and particularly local journalism, have in convening people? And what can we learn from some initiatives that are trying to convene people around the concept of joy? You know, maybe this is just me being responsive to like being depressed about things. Like, I need some joy. Sure. But like, there's a number of really interesting things happening where news organizations are saying, okay, we might be in a community where there's been a lot of negative coverage, but you know, they're doing things like having community joy days where they're bringing people together to be able to connect and build solidarities in a kind of positive situation. And I'm interested in sort of looking at what can be learned from some of those initiatives. I'm also working on a project looking at how to support the information needs of communities going through resettlement as refugees. And I'm hoping in the, you know, my non-existent future spare time, I really want to think more about peace journalism, which is something that a lot of people are doing really interesting, important work on. But I've been kind of thinking about in the background for a long time because I do have, you know, practitioner background in international journalism. And I want to kind of think about some of the connection points between local journalism and like the problems of parachute journalism at the local level. And then at the international level, of course, there's a long history of conversations about, you know, parachute foreign correspondents and that kind of thing. So.
Huh. Well, we look forward to hearing more about that when you're ready to share. It all sounds great. Once again, thank you so much for being a part of the New Books Network. Andrea Wenzel is the author of Anti-Racist Journalism, The Challenge of Creating Equitable Local News, and is associate professor in the Klein College of Media and Communication at Temple University. Andrea, congratulations on this really valuable work, and thanks so much for joining us on the New Books Network.
Thank you, Garrett.